Right, so my charge here has been to tell you or give an idea or discuss how well we can measure or characterize gravitational wave sources, and in particular spin, since that's one of the parameters that you care the most when you want to go after axions. Right, so I'm obliged by contract to show this slide. You know, every time I give a talk, I have to tell gravitational waves a ripple on the fabric of space-time and so on and so forth. But you know all of this, so I can just go very quickly or skip. I'll just point to Ray with a LEGO Nobel Prize medal. We tried to get money out of LEGO. Then we're going to sponsorize you. That didn't work. All right, so very quickly, what is it out there that LIGO will go after that we know of? There are a bunch of you know, sources we have on mind. For some of them, we have a pretty good model, or we understand what the signal should look like. Probably the one you are most familiar with is compact binaries, like binary black holes that I'm going to spend most of my time with today, or neutron star binaries, or any combination. Then we also have a persistent signal from asymmetric neutron stars or axion clouds. They're there. And so for both of these, we have a pretty good idea what the models, what the signal will look like. Then we also have sources which are more uncertain, both in terms of their astrophysical rates and the signal. The most famous are probably core collapse supernovae. We know they exist. We don't really have a very good idea of what the signal is or how it looks like. And then there is the stochastic background, which here I'm representing with a pond during a rainy day, which is made by the overlap of all the signals which taken individually may be too weak to be resolved, but altogether give you or can give you a measurable signal. Right, so today I'm going to only focus on compact binaries, and you will hear more on continuous waves, which is also relevant for this workshop, by Sylvia and Kate later today. Right, so I'm going to focus on compact binaries. I don't think I need to convince you that compact binaries are nice, interesting, and you know, useful for astrophysics and physics. And when I say compact objects, since yesterday someone mentioned white dwarf, I explicitly focus on neutron stars and black holes, and today only on black holes, really. And we know that they host some of the most extreme conditions, physical conditions, met in the universe. For neutron stars, we have a lot of stuff packed up in you know, a few kilometers of radius. We don't know how matter behaves. Until a year ago, we didn't know, or we were not sure, that neutron star binaries were related to gamma ray burst production. Now we know that that is indeed the case. And you know, related to this point here, we have not really a good idea of how matter behaves in this extreme condition and how neutron star can get, how large they can get. For black holes, it's even more extreme, of course, because we have even more material packed together. We want to understand how fast they can spin. And, you know, we have heard yesterday from Jack and related discussion that X-ray binaries seems to be finding a broad distribution of black hole spins, while LIGO so far have found small spin with some caveat, okay, that we can talk about later. We want to know how big they can get. We know we have black holes of tens of solar masses or millions of solar masses. We don't know if there is anything in between. And to understand how they get formed throughout the cosmic history, what we know for sure is that they produce extreme gravitational field, and hence a very good question is whether relativity still holds true nearby a black hole. And just for today, we want to know whether they form massive axion clouds. Right, so one of the charges I've been given is also to give you somehow at least a decent understanding of how we measure these parameters and what in the waveform signal tell us about what parameters. So a good analogy I heard a few years ago from Schechter, Paul Schechter at MIT, is that, you know, he showed me this plot of the CMB, of course, you're all familiar with. Now, I'm not a cosmologist, but I know that if you look at this, by how many peaks you have, the relative ratio of the height of the peak, and so on and so forth, you learn different things about the universe and about cosmology. The same thing could be said, you know, looking at a gravitational wave coming from a compact binary coalescence like this one. If I look at this, you know, for example, I can tell you that very likely there is no spin precession because there is no amplitude modulation. by looking at the time scale, I can get an idea of the mass. This was a very massive system because it emerged very quickly, and so on and so forth.
You should really update your clock with Planck.
Yeah, sorry.
It's much, much better now.
I did this like while you guys were drinking coffee. Apologize. Right, so what determines this waveform, its shape, and so on and so forth? Well, if you neglect at zeroth order eccentricity and matter effect, like tidal deformability, then a signal from a compact binary depends on 15 parameters which are listed here. You have the two masses, you have 3 degrees of freedom for each spin, since they can be vector, 2 for sky position, 2 for orientation, and then a reference time and phase, and the distance to the source. If you add matter effects, which we have done, for example, for the BNS, then you get 2 more parameters. Now, it's important to realize that not all these parameters affect the waveform evolution, both in phase and amplitude, in the same way. And in particular, if you, what we typically do, develop the phase evolution of a waveform in a power series of V over C, then there are terms like the parameters like the Chern mass, which is this weird combination of the two masses that we love in LIGO and Virgo. Then that parameter enters at the lowest PN order, so it's multiplied by V over C to the zero, which means that we measure it very well. Then next up, you have the mass ratio, which enters at a slightly higher positronic order. So it means it's slightly harder to measure, and it enters at a frequency which is slightly higher. Then you have the spins, and then you have matter effect at the highest order, 5 and 6 PN. So this already tells you, or should suggest, that parameters like masses are going to be easier to measure typically than spins, which are going to be easier to measure than matter effects. Now, this is, again, zeroth order consideration. Reality is more complicated.
Sorry. Is the Chern mass,
what is that?
Is the Chern mass primarily measured through the phase or the amplitude?
Well, it enters in both, but it's mainly determined by the phasing evolution. It enters also in the amplitude with some power, like 5/6 or something like this. Now, another important consideration, especially for spin, which is our topic of today, is that some of these parameters are more or less badly correlated. In particular, the two correlations that you probably heard of, even just reading LIGO's paper, are distance versus inclination and the mass ratio versus spin. Now, this latter, it's only through degeneracy in the limit where you have only the spiral of the signal in band, so low mass black hole binaries or neutron stars. And also if the spins are aligned. If any of these two conditions is not true anymore, and I'll give examples later, this degeneracy is partially or totally broken. Now, at zero, like a cartoon of what degeneracy means, these are two waveforms which have the same total mass. The one at the top has aligned spins of 0.9 and mass ratio of 0.5. The one at the bottom has no spin and mass ratio of 0.4. And now, this is just to impress you. In reality, there are differences in there. But the idea I want to give you is that you can play with these two parameters and get to waveforms which are very, very similar. And that indeed is, it's what correlations are. Now, today, the one which is more important for us is the one about mass ratio and spins. Now, in reality, Mina told me, please, Salvo, talk about waveforms and how parameters enter. But we don't measure parameters by looking at waveforms or by looking at these things here, which you see in our papers, they're called omega scans. We don't make detection by eye. We don't spend days. I have an image here. I'm not very good at Photoshopping. That's the best I could do. We don't spend our days doing that. We have sophisticated algorithms that, search for waveforms in data and measure their parameters. So most likely, if you look at one of these and you find a random, bright pixel is not a signal or many signals or echoes of signals. Since I'm a perimeter, I have to say that, sorry. Okay, right. How can we make things better? I said some of these degeneracies are only strictly true if your spins are aligned with the orbital angular momentum. Now, in the most generic case, you could think that your spin vectors or black holes can have, some other orientation, and then you have a total angular momentum J, and the orbit precesses, or L precesses around J. Now, this is nice because physically it gives you much more, content, you have spin orbit coupling, spin coupling. And in terms of waveform, what happens is that while without precession, you have just an increasingly monotonically increasing amplitude, when there is precession, you can have amplitude modulation and also phase modulation, although it's hard to see here. Right. So having this amplitude modulation can break the degeneracies, you know, distance inclination and spin mass ratio. And let me show you how this works out in practice. So this is a plot from a paper from 2014, before black holes were cool for most people. And the point here I want to make is how better you can do if you have precession. Right, so in this plot I have on the x-axis the network SNR of signals, black hole binaries, these are 10, 5 BBHs. And on the y-axis I have the 1 sigma uncertainty in the relative uncertainty in the measurements of the primary black hole. By convention, in LIGO Virgo, the primary is the most massive object. Right, what the color bar is the inclination angle of the orbit, right? So it's basically the angle between J, in this case, and your eye, okay? But something I forgot to mention here is that, and will be relevant later, is that even though you may have precession, like in this case, there are the amount of precession you see in your detector, it's also a function of this angle, the line of sight. In particular, even if there is precession, but you're looking at the system from face on, like this way, so L or J points at you, you don't see basically any modulation. And on the other extreme, any little amount of modulation will be very visible if you look at the system from the edge. Okay, you can think of it just like a plate, right? And this is what this color bar is meant to show. This color here is the, indeed, is that angle, is the line of sight angle, the inclination angle. And someone just broke the conference room. Right, so in all these systems, you okay? You're fine? Okay. In all these systems, there is, in the detector frame, the same amount of precession for the same symbols. Forget about the shape and the size. That's for another talk. The point I want to make here is that for the same systems, if you observe them from angles which are very close to a John, so 1 radians or so, you can get uncertainties which are a factor of 2 or 3 better than what you would do for the same system if you saw it from face on or face off. And that is true at all SNRs. And the other point here is that you can get uncertainty of a few percent in the component spins for ISNR, caveat, these are 1 sigma, they are not the 90% uncertainty that we typically quote in LIGO. I'll go back to those later. And also worth mentioning that another thing that can make your estimation better is if the mass ratio gets larger, because the spin effect can be enhanced by larger mass ratio. So if you can do, you know, between 5 and tens of percent with 10, 5 BBHs, you can do even better if you have, say, a neutron star black hole. And here you can go down to a few percent. And again, it is the case that typically looking at the system from close to a John gives you a better uncertainty.
Because the angular momentum is dominated by the spin of the massive guy, right? Yeah. This is just for the spin of the massive guy. Right?
Yeah. We typically cannot measure the secondary object spin very well or at all. Now, so this is just a few points. And what we have done later with a bunch of friends is to give a more, you know, thorough investigation of how the uncertainty depends on the inclination angle. So what this plot is showing you is in the y-axis, now I have the 90% uncertainty. So this kind of comparable with what we publish in LIGO papers. And the different bullet points here are different black hole binaries with different mass ratios, total mass, SNRs, and inclination angle. That doesn't really matter. The point here I want to drive is that indeed, it is typically the case, not always, that if you measure the same system with the same signal-to-noise ratio at increasingly large inclination angle, the uncertainty on the spin reaches a minimum where you're looking at the system this way, a John, and a maximum when you're looking at the system close from face on or face off. There are exceptions. And one exception is if the mass ratio is very close to 1, which are these, what's this called in English? I don't know.
Purple?
Yeah, I know, the shape.
Diamond.
Thank you very much. I don't play clearly poker. Right, in this case it's roughly flat. The other big exception is when the spins are aligned. So in all these guys here, I have some amount of precession. You can see here because the angle between spins and L are non-zero. These guys here instead are perfectly aligned with the orbit, so there is no precession. And in that case, you always get a typically good uncertainty measurements. There are caveats again. You're very close to the edge of the prior, so your posterior is artificially squished. But anyhow, the point here is that if you look at this, you will tell me, okay, Salvo, it's great. If I want to, you know, measure spins very well, I only need to get a bunch of these guys here, and I'll do a factor of, you know, many better than what I can do when I'm face on.
Salvo, just one question on that analysis: you include inspired merger and ring down?
Yeah, these are AMR waveforms. Yeah, there are other caveats in that case that enter, like there is no higher order modes, but for mass ratio of two,
yeah,
it's probably fine. Right, so why isn't this as good news as it seems? Because there is the small text you have to read. And the truth is that it is much easier to detect events which are face-on and face-off than it is to detect events or sources which are edge-on. Why? Again, this is my great skills in making cartoons. Because if you look at a CBC, which is emitting gravitational waves, more gravitational waves, more energy goes along plus and minus L, and the least amount of energy goes along the direction of the plane, right? So this means that if you're looking at the system from this way, you can see it farther away because you get more energy, while if you're looking at the system from the edge, it has to be very close to give you the same SNR. And since I also broke something. And since farther away there is more universe, your typical event will be like this or like this, okay? And this was indeed obtained by Schutz. In a few years ago, you just focus on the blue distribution here. I will go back to the green later. So the blue distribution, it's basically the distribution of the expected inclination angle for compact binaries. It's, I call it the McDonald distribution, but it is really made of two parts. One is the fact that if you just put a random spin on a sphere, it will be isotropically distributed, so it will go like sine, iota. On the top of that, though, you have to fold in the fact that more energy goes along iota equals zero or pi. If you put the two things together, you have this curve here, which tells you that the typical inclination angle for advanced detectors will be around 30 degrees modulo pi. And indeed, most of the events, actually all of the events which we have detected so far, are consistent with being in this area here. And unfortunately, getting something very close to pi over 2 is it's hard. That will change in the future. I will go back to this point later. Another important thing is that most of the information when you want to measure spins comes from the inspiral, okay? And so this means that the heavier your binary black hole gets, the harder it is to measure the spins, right? And this is somehow also shown in this cartoon where on the x-axis, on the y-axis, I have again the 90% uncertainty on the spin. 90% uncertainty means that if you see 0.9, you're not measuring anything. You're getting the prior back, basically. And on the x-axis, I have the detector frame chirp mass. So the right means more heavier. And the color bar gives you the true spin that I injected for the primary black hole. So the redder, the more spin, right? And you see a few interesting things here. First of all is that we typically suck at measuring component spins, okay? Like this here is the distribution, basically, the projection of these points on the y direction. And you see that the bulk of the distribution of the events that you detect will have spins which are component spins, which are basically close to be unmeasurable.
So, this assumes something about the mass ratio?
These, that's a good point. These are flat component masses between 30 and 50 solar masses, if I'm not wrong. And the reason for that choice in particular is because we started working on this right after 1509-14, which is the point here, and realized that there was basically nothing in the literature that showed how well you can characterize heavy binary black holes.
But
there were a bunch of papers on light binary black holes.
Your mass ratio is basically
close to unity. Yeah, yeah.
So how, if you were to change it to something else?
It would get better. On the other end, that's one of the things we want to do in the next few years. But up to now, the mass distribution of the black holes we have detected seems to be quite consistent with being a power law a power law, which means that most, you know, events will be close to equal mass. And that seems to be supported by population synthesis studies, both from global cluster and because of Carl, maybe we'll mention this tomorrow.
How much do you have to change Q, the mass ratio, to get start getting improving on this?
I want to say you have to go back, you have to a mass ratio below maybe 3, 4, something like this.
Okay.
So yeah, being close to equal mass is really penalizing for measuring spins and also a few other things. But
I mean, there's still going to be events at 60, for example. There's
yeah.
Some events that you do very well.
That's the other point I wanted to make. Something's shaking. Is that as was the case for the X-ray binaries yesterday, Jack mentioned, measuring high spin, it's easier than measuring, you know, weak spin, low spins, okay? That's true for us too. So most of the good points are very close to, you know, large spins. Okay, this the plot on the right is making again the same point here, is that for most of your events with advanced lag and Virgo, no matter what the true value of the spin is, which is the blue, the green diamond, basically you're getting the prior. So you're getting a median, which is close to 0.5, and the error bars, which get the whole space.
Can you say something in general about the different priors that go into this regarding like the...
I'll go back to that in a second.
Okay.
More than a second. A second and some reference. Right. So the other point, as I said, is that you can kind of see it, although it's very hard there, that as you go to higher masses, maybe you don't get as many good measurements because you lose the spiral, you only have the merger ring down. And this is a cartoon that shows the same thing, even push even farther away. That's the uncertainty of measuring the spin for three representative systems. Again, I mean, this is only mass ratio 1 and 2, okay, that's Q. And again, the detector frame total mass. And the point that this plot is making is, again, as you increase the mass, the uncertainty of the spin gets larger and larger. And I should say that there are even better studies on this point by Carl, who is here on the audience, and Philip Graf. So they specifically looked at intermediate mass black holes and how well you can characterize them.
Why is the bottom curve so much better than the other two?
Because it's a line spin. It's large and a line spin. So there is a thing. In the literature, until a few years ago, you would find claims that measuring the spins, it's easier if the spins are precessing than if they are aligned. Now, that was true then. It's not true in general if your mass is high enough, because if your mass is high enough, then you have the merger ring down in band, which is not the case if you have, say, a 5-5 solar mass black hole. So why does that make a difference? It makes a difference because suppose you did not have the merger ring down in band, then you could play with mass ratio and spin basically in a totally free way that gives you a lot of degeneracy, so the spin sucks. But now if you have the measuring down in band, what happens is the following. If you change the spin, in particular the projection of the spin along L, that makes the waveform longer or shorter. It's something which is called the orbital and gap effect. Okay, I will mention it again later. Now, you cannot compensate for, the only way theoretically in which you can compensate and change the length of the waveform, it's changing the chair mass, because the chair mass or the total mass also affect the length. But they also, as you asked earlier, they also affect very heavily the phase evolution. So, okay, whatever. To make a long story short, if you have the merger ring down in band, which is the case for these events here, which I did not put the mass, but these are, again, 30-30 solar mass, or around 70 solar mass total, then the merger ring down makes it such that measuring a line spin, it's easy. Now, there is also a part of, you know, a caveat here is that I quickly said before, you have prior effects. When you are at 0.9 spin, true spin, you're very close to the edge of 1. So a posterior maybe get, you know, instead of being this, when you are, say, at 0.4, if you are close to the edge of 1, it may be something like this. It may be squished against the posterior, which may make it artificially look narrower if you measure the 90% uncertainty.
So for the
who is that, Aaron?
Just to be clear, for the aligned, when you say aligned spin runs here, do you mean the recovery is also using an aligned spin waveform?
No.
Or are these all recovery?
It uses the full processing waveform.
Okay.
It's injected aligned, but thank you very much. So the template here does not assume that the spin is aligned. It searches the full 6 degrees of freedom.
Oh.
confused between the green and the red. The only difference is the mass ratio.
Yeah.
The one with the bigger mass ratio is smaller error bars, but it's the other.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Oh,
oh no, wait, there may be a typo here. I think
it's... Yeah, it should be
the... Actually, I think one of you picked this up and I did not correct. I corrected on the archive, but I got this from the PRD. Yeah, thank you. It's the other way around. Yeah. Thank you. Maybe that's why I was invited to be scolded again. Okay, so all of these points, though, you know, made people a bit skeptical. There are even papers like this one by, you know, a bunch of very good colleagues about whether we can even measure in the first place component spins. Now, you can read the paper. It's here. The point is that it's hard, right? It will be harder, on average, for the typical event to measure its their component spins. So can we do anything else? Yes, there is something we can do, although it may be not directly relevant for you guys and to go after axions. Because the thing is that although the individual spins are hard to measure, there is a particular composition or sum of the two spins, which is typically called the chi effetti, which is basically you can think of it as the mass-weighted projection of the total spin along L. Okay, is this guy here? And clearly, you can see I really care about people sitting in the back of the room. This character is huge. Right, so why do we like this quantity? There are a few reasons. One of them is that it's conserved at least up to the second false Newtonian order. So it's a good quantity. It's going to be conserved throughout the phase evolution. And the second one is that unlike the component spins, we can measure this chi effective pretty well. I'm going to show it in a second. And the third point, although this is kind of an historical, you know, reversal of what happened, is that it can be used to try to understand which formation channel created your black holes. Now, in reality, people thought about this only after we realized that that's the only thing we could measure. That's fine. Okay, so very quickly, why does the last point happen? And that's going to be Carl's talk tomorrow, so I'm not going to say anything in detail. But the idea is that there are mainly two formation channels that people have in mind for these binary black holes. One of them is called the dynamical capture, which is represented in the right, on the right plot from a paper by Carl Rodriguez and also our Carl. And now what this is basically is typically formation through multi-body encounters that should happen in densely populated environments like Gobler cluster. And then you have, you know, two black holes that orbit. There is another black hole that comes in. Okay, they can swap positions and whatever. And so this is very close to, you know, many personal relationship. You have two bodies and then something else happens and one of the two is kicked out and the third one takes the place. And then you have a much more boring situation, which is where the two black holes were two normal stars to start with. One went supernova and became a black hole. The other went supernova and became a black hole. And then eventually they merged. This is called typically a common or can be driven by common envelope evolution and is expected to happen in galactic fields. Now, the key difference among these two scenarios is that in the globular cluster scenario, you have a random encounter. So a priori, you do not expect the spins of the two objects to have any preferred orientation. They just met randomly, okay? So if you think then in terms of total spin, the total spin can be oriented any way with respect to the orbital angular momentum. So in particular, it can be along plus L, so positive projection, or negative projection. This should not happen instead for this other channel. Because of friction and common envelope and torques, people expect that most of the times, the spins of black holes formed through this scenario will be roughly aligned with each other and with plus L. So if you form the total spin of these systems, you would expect it to have a positive, you know, projection. So chi effective would be positive. So the point is that if you can measure the sign of chi effective, you know, or something related to it, you could maybe distinguish between these two scenarios. And again, Carl will talk about it tomorrow. The only reason I mention this is because I want to justify why we care about this chi effective. And the point is that, as I said, we can measure it pretty well, much, much better than what we can measure the individual spins. Now, the cartoon on the right, it's, again, using the same data point as before, so these heavy binary black holes, like 15914, which is here. Again, you have the total mass, sorry, the chirp mass in the detector frame versus the 90% uncertainty of measuring chi effective. And this is the true chi effective here. It can be positive or negative. And you can see that while before, for the component spins, most times we had basically no measurements. In here, you know, for half of my events, I can measure the chi-effective with an uncertainty of 0.3, 0.4, which is not bad. And unlike the component spins, in here, you're actually measuring the chi-effective. So the measurements, the median and the error bar, kind of track the true value of chi-effective. So that's good news. It means that we can measure this guy. And how did, then, the LIGO and Virgo collaboration do? This point here shows you that for 15914, you do indeed get something that kind of makes sense.
Oh, this is still for a population.
That's the AV, yeah, the same population as before.
Okay.
Exactly. Right, so this is what we have done with LIGO so far. And I'm sorry for this. I don't want to mess up with you, but in the paper, this plot were vertical. I had to do some sophisticated manipulation here. Because I wanted this to look like this. Right. So in here you have for all the black hole banneries that we have published so far with the LVC, you have the chi-effective posterior. And going back to Jack's question, I will go back even in more detail later, the black curve here is the prior. Okay, on chi-effective, which comes from a prior which is flat in the magnitude of the component spin and the uniform in the angle. If you put all these things together, you do the projection, you get this black distribution for this chi-effective. And now, what you can notice? You will notice that there is only one event, the 15, 12, 26, for which we could really say something quite precisely and confidently about its sign. The 15, 12, 26 seem to have a positive chi-effective. You see, the posterior stops well before zero. For the event of June 2017, kind of, I mean, there is some tail on the negative side, but it's mostly positive. For all the other events, they seem to be centered at zero or very close to zero, so both signs are theoretically possible. And the other thing that you will notice is that most of this seems to have a tail which goes on the right side, much more pronounced than the one that goes on the left side. And I'll go back to this point in a second. Now, going back to Jack, I want indeed to focus explicitly on priors. So as I just said, what we publish as the LIGO-Virgo collaboration as, you know, their posterior distribution, if you do Bayesian analysis, a posterior involves likelihood and priors. So you have to specify a prior. Now, as I said, what we have done, it's a quite reasonable assumption, uniform in magnitude for the component spins, and isotropic in direction. However, these are not the only, you know, choices that make sense. You know, you can get the X-ray binary measurements and use that to inform your choice. Or you can think that most black holes have large spins, and the one at low spins that you got is because you have systematics or new physics, right? So one thing that we have done last year, actually with a bunch of people here, Carl and Aaron, is to check for some of the events that we detected as LVC, how much the results depend on your choice of the prior, okay? I think that addresses exactly your question. And you may expect that, in particular for weak events, the answer should be a lot. Because if your event is weak, the likelihood is rough, is not that peaked, so the prior matters a lot. So what I'm showing here, I'm sorry for the resolution, in this panel here are the different priors that we used. One of them, the green one, for example, assumes that spins are only positively along plus L. And one of them assumes that the tip of the vector, of the spin vector, is uniform on the sphere, the tip, not the angle, okay? Which is called volumetric prior, and a few others, Gaussian with low magnitude, Gaussian with high magnitude, and so on and so forth. And we have reanalyzed the actual LIGO data, which by then was public. So as far as I know, this paper is the first paper that used LIGO data with non-LIGO authors that didn't claim that LIGO was wrong, okay? Right, so we analyzed 15914, 15-12-26, and the marginal LVT event, so the three events of the first science run, with these priors. And what did we learn? We learned that for most priors, for 15914, say you get basically the same thing, but if you make your prior strong enough, these two distributions, blue and green, are Gaussian priors, either aligned, so Gaussian in tilt, or in magnitude, in which case you can move it quite a lot. And so that's fine. But now look at the interesting thing here. The interesting thing is that if you get the 15, 12, 26, which was the only one which has a positive chi effective with the default prior, well, the chi effective stays positive no matter what you do to the prior under some, you know, should I put a star here? Like,
what if you could take a prior that had like the green
exactly
opposite side?
That's what I mean by here, should I put a star? No matter means under reasonable assumption. You can do that. I mean, these guys here have very strong negative tails, but if you make that guy here,
yeah.
My guess is that you'll have some negative, but I'm not 100% sure. I can do it. If you want to, for $5, I'll do it. Right, okay. And so, you know, there is some movement here. Things change a bit, but the main point that was that 15-12 was not consistent with being negative stays true if you, under reasonable priors, okay? We can make it unreasonable and make them like picked a minus one, but you know, astrophysically may be a bit questionable. And then of course for the LBT event, which was the weakest one, of course things can move a lot because as I said, if the SNR is low, then the prior matters a lot. All right, what else can go wrong? There are a few other things which are important, and that's that comes from a paper that hit the archive a few days ago. Again, Chris and Aaron are involved. I don't seem to be able to get...
Carl.
What did I say?
Carl. You said Chris.
Okay, Carl. Sorry, Carl. Sorry, Chris and Carl. right. So what else needs to be taken into account? There is the effect I mentioned before, which is called orbital and gap. And it basically tells you that if you have systems with large spins, whose projection is along plus L, the waveform will be a bit longer. You get more energy. If the projection of the spin is along minus L, the waveform is shorter, you get less energy. So this means that you can see events with large positive chi effective farther away than events with large negative chi effective. And that means that there is a selection bias. It means that even if your true underlying astrophysical distribution of chi effective were to be perfectly symmetric along zero, which as Carl would say tomorrow is what you expect from global cluster, the distribution of the detectable observed chi effective will be slightly moved toward the positive side because events with positive chi effective are easier to measure than events with negative chi effective. So one of the things we wanted to check is how big this effect is and you know, whether it can be a problem for us in the near future. So in this paper here, you'll find a big table like this that contains several possible true underlying distribution for the spin, because of course, how large this effect is depends on how large the true spins can be, you know, in the universe. If all the black holes are 0.1, of course, this effect will be negligible because, you know, minus 0.1 or plus 0.1 doesn't really change anything. On the other hand, if all black holes in the universe are like your 0.98, plus or minus, then this effect can be very large. So this table shows that I think it's a quite reassuring table. It shows you that even in the worst case where the true underlying population can very easily produce large spins, the offset with respect to the true thing, which would be 50%, it's on the order of 10%. So you get 10% extra positive chi effective than you would in the source frame. And this bias gets smaller and smaller as your true underlying spin distribution produces smaller and smaller spins. So in this one, for example, produces spin magnitude, which are normally distributed around zero with a sigma 0.05. So basically there is no effect. But the truth is that we don't know where we are. We don't know what the real universe is. So as we get more and more events, we should start paying attention to these potential systematic effects and selection effects.
Salvo,
is this the,
Luis? This is the best way of doing this? Because I was imagining that you could do something where the distribution in masses changes to and have all events be comparable in the SNR.
So what this is, it's not exactly that, it's kind of that. What we have done here, it's we have generated a gazillions of events which are with a power law mass distribution, okay, for the black holes, and a spin distribution which follows this. All of this, and uniform incoming volume, so most events will be far away and so on and so forth, and uniform in the sky and so on and so forth. For each of those, we have calculated the SNR, and we have kept only events which have SNR larger than 8, okay? That's the reason for the depletion. Is depletion a word in English? Probably depletion, thank you, in here. The problem if you're not an English speaker is that things are not pronounced the way they're written. Okay, anyhow, there is something else which is important. So what I just said is true for the population, but even on an event-by-event basis, you need to be careful. And why? Because again of our degeneracy between mass ratio and spins. If you remember, I told you before that 15-12-26 was the only event for which we could exclude that the spin was zero, the Kaifetti spin. So as soon as I saw that, I'm sure I'm not the only one, I asked myself the question, if 15-12-26 were the same event with the same SNR, but with negative spin, could I have excluded that the spin was positive? And I said, okay, let's check. And the answer was no. So what you see, for example, in this cartoon here, it's 2D posterior of mass ratio versus chi effective. For these are software replica of a 15-12-26 event. So an event that looks basically like 15-12-26. And you see a characteristic banana shape. And you see indeed that the posterior excludes zero and has a very long tail. And what the red thing is, it's an event with the same SNR, same masses, same sky position, but the chi effect now is negative with the same magnitude. And what you see is that now you cannot exclude that the true value was positive after you get a very long tail. And now the reason why this happens boils down to mass ratio, as I said, a chi effective degeneracies. And if you want to know more of the gory details, Aaron is the guy you want to talk to. He wrote the whole appendix in the paper where we explain analytically how you can show this with a toy model. But again, it's basically just boils down to the shape of these curves and the fact that you have a very long tail in here and you have an edge at one and also some coordinate transformation. Anyhow.
Sorry, I got confused. You said you flip this spin and it's the same SNR.
Because I moved the distance, yeah.
Oh, you change the distance.
Yeah, because I wanted an apple-to-apple comparison, right? Because if I only change the spin, of course, the SNR will get slightly smaller. So maybe that's why now it's worse. So I made it a bit closer. We made it a bit closer. Mina?
What about mass ratio? Why does it look like it's consistently for low mass ratio that you start getting this effect of going to higher...
Wait. Well, in this case, the true mass ratio is the same for all of them. It's 0.8. Okay, so these are not different events. This is the measurement for a single event seen in 2D space.
You saw where all the possibilities for Q. And
I just measure. I just measure Q. Yeah. And we measure this 15-dimensional parameter space, and then you can project in whatever dimensionality you want. And this is again, and this is the projection of this in a 1D parameter space of chi-effective. Of chi effective only. Michaelis.
This tail is because of the mass Q degeneracy or something. But isn't it partly because the effect of spin is kind of asymmetric? So if you change the spin to a negative direction.
There is a sine effect too.
So the waveform changes more dramatically when you go to negative spins than when you go to.
We saw something similar, yeah, on the.
So I mean the lopsided shape of the posterior is kind of makes sense whether you measure the spin here.
It's not always the case though, and yeah, I don't want to say something.
You're right. There's essentially symmetry here, right? So you can imagine, you can see the shape of the degeneracy on this plot, right? The bananas are stretched along the contours of degeneracy, and the reason why you get such a difference between positive and negative spins is that you still physically can only have systems that are equal mass ratio. So if you could add in, like was discussed yesterday for the X-ray binders, if you could add in a dummy unphysical parameter that could allow you to explore an unphysical space, then the blue contour would continue upward and you would get essentially just as much degeneracy uncertainty in that case.
I'm like less than
but that doesn't happen here. So when you have negative spins, you basically are allowed to explore more of the physical space, the degeneracy.
All right, people. My only bound is a bus at 5 p.m. So beside that, I can, like, we're like halfway through-ish. So, okay.
Just a quick question, though. But it seems like for the spin flip one, the true mass ratio is excluded at whatever sigma.
That's 50%. That's 50%. Yeah, I don't know how much I would believe the contours, but it's 50%. Yeah, it's fine. I mean, it can happen. It's not, if you do measurements 10% of the time, the true value would be outside of the 90% confidence level, and so on and so forth.
But is there a reason why it's centered at a much lower Q value as opposed to the,
I mean, I don't know if it's sent. Well, we don't have. Let's talk about it later. I have this plot with the actual posterior everywhere. We can check where it is centered. Do you remember if that was or Carl, where the max of the posterior was for this one? Okay, we'll do it over lunch. Don't worry. We have the answer for you somewhere. All right. So maybe I should start getting a bit faster at this point. The other thing I want to say, though, is that, remember, this degeneracy I mentioned at the beginning, it's only strictly true in the spiral phase. So you may think that as I increase the mass of my black holes, I have more and more merger in down in band, and that will help me break in this, so this will not hold true anymore. And that's a very good assumption, and we wanted to check it because 15, 12, 26 was on the low mass side of things. So what we have done after this particular run is that we have simulated a bunch more events, or we have simulated much more events with more choices of masses, mass ratio, SNR, and chi effective, and look for systematic trends, in particular for the skewness. And another thing which maybe is not apparent here is that if you measure the 90% uncertainty of this, it's much smaller than the 90% uncertainty of this. So this projection effect is telling you that it's harder to measure negative chi-effective than it is to measure positive chi-effective, at least for 15-12. Let's see if it is true in general. So first off, skewness. So what we have done then, as I said, is we have simulated a bunch of binary black holes and even neutron stars, actually, because if the degeneracy is in the spiral, it should be even stronger for neutron stars, where you only have in spiral. So these are different mass ratios and total mass, and these curves span various true chi effective from negative minus 0.7 to positive plus 0.7. And what you can see is that for basically all events with equal mass and mass ratio up to 2, the skewness defined as the third moment, whatever, it's positive. So indeed, you have this tail on the right much more often than you have, longer tail on the right. Things can change a bit, and this can go again toward the direction that Aaron was mentioning as you go away from the edge of the Q equal 1 prior. So if you have events with mass ratio of 3, say, which are this dot dashed, then you can get a different behavior. But if you believe that events are masses follow a power law, most of them will have mass ratio close to 1. So most of them will have a long tail on the toward the positive side. And this implies, again, that if you get the same event, same SNR, you flip the sign of chi-effective, you measure the uncertainty, you build the ratio. So this plot is the ratio of the 90% uncertainty of measuring chi-effective for an event where spin is negative and given on the x-axis versus the same event with the same SNR but positive chi-effective. And you see that it's always larger than 1, no matter what your system is. And it gets larger and larger as the true chi-effective increases and goes away from 0. So for example, this plot is telling you that if you get something like 15-12, which was roughly 15-7, 15-8, something like this, the red dashed, and if the true chi-effective were 0.3, then that system with negative 0.3 would give you an uncertainty which is 3 times larger than the same system with chi-effective of plus 0.3. So bottom line is that it's easier to measure positive chi-effective than it is to measure negative chi-effective. All right, and last thing on this, you can do it yourself as part of this paper. We put online a very crude, I'm a physicist, I don't know how to do nice things, a posterior generator, basically, in which you can put your desired masses and SNR and tilts. You click go, and either crashes or gives you, simulated posteriors that follow these, more realistic geometries that we have found. So it's there, and sorry for the name. I didn't pick superstring. They gave it to me. Okay.
Are you invading the string group?
Say again?
Are you invading the string group at MIT?
No, this is a LIGO computer. I don't know why it's called superstring. I don't know. Anyhow, and last thing before I change topic, it's something which is important for this workshop, which is the final black hole spin. So, we have this merger, we form a black hole, how well can we measure its spin? And well, the answer is pretty well. So in these cartoons here, you see again for chirp mass versus uncertainty. This is the 90% absolute uncertainty, and this is the relative uncertainty in percent, so that's 10%. For the same events you saw before, and this in the color bar is the true final spin. And notice that it's always quite large. And someone mentioned it before, just by conservation of angular momentum, typically even if your initial black holes don't have spin, you get something which is around 0.6, 0.7, something like this. And indeed, my leftover black holes have all quite large spin. And we can measure this true value with uncertainty, which are typically, you know, a few percent to a few tens of percent, depending on how long the system is. Again, heavier means shorter in spiral. And we are measuring the final spin from the initial masses and spins. And if you want, I don't really know how this works in detail, but likely we have Nathan there in the audience, and he knows all the details of this calculation. Thank you, Nathan. And sorry for just you. Anyhow, so the bottom line is that we can measure final spins typically much better than we can measure the initial spin. So if we want to, if the point here is that we want to monitor this new black hole from the beginning, chances are we know the starting condition pretty well. Okay.
Maybe just emphasize that point, yeah. Right? I mean, if you were to measure the spin just from the post-merger part, you would get a much larger error.
Right, exactly. And thank you, buddy, because this argument actually is used, for example, for tests of GRs, because you know, if GR is correct, then if you measure the final spin from the initial objects and directly from the final objects, they should agree unless there is something weird going on in the, say, in the merger. And I think Nathan, you're also involved with this, with Archisman, people have done this kind of tests. You're involved with that, right? Yeah, okay. Good.
We measure it directly, I'm not using quasi-normals.
Right, but you measure from the whole...
Except way. They're also using those fits. I mean, what you really need is a ring down analysis.
Yeah.
Which would have larger...
That's even worse, it's even harder than, yeah, absolutely. All right, let me, okay. I've been talking for a long time, but these are sensitivity right now. The only point I want to make is that if we want to do better, we're typically limited, except for Virgo, which has still a lot of technical noises. We're typically limited at high frequency by shot noise, and at low frequency, which means here, tens of hertz, by thermal noise. And both of those should get a bit better over the next few years.
Are these current when you say when we're at?
This comes from after one, from after O2, I believe. So when Virgo went online after the August 14 event. All right, so where are we? This is a kind of very quick intermediate summary. The only point I care about is that up to now, what we have detected, which is 6 binary black holes and a neutron star, we have shown indeed that it is the case that spins, component spins are hard to measure, and typical events are face-on or face-off. And there is here a short summary. You can see it, what we have done. And neutron star, that's me, Michaelis, 39 minutes after the BNS discovery. And this was at a conference in Amsterdam where a bunch of people were, or France too, I don't know where France is, but it was there. Anyhow, it was very exciting. During that conference, we had like 45 events happen or something. Okay, so the point is that with these events, we have estimated or got a good idea of the merger, 45 was a, where's the camera? It was an exaggeration. We don't really have 45 events. we have measured the merger rate of neutron star and black holes. And by extrapolating, this implies that over the next few years, we'll detect typically, or we expect to detect tens or hundreds of binary black holes and quite a few neutron star binaries. And hopefully more events, meaning other kind of events. But now the thing is that most of these will still be weak, face on and face off, and that is not good for spins. So before the organizers kill me, what can we do better then? What we can do better at this point, it's only build something else which changes what our typical event will look like. And a possible way forwards are to build something on the ground. Of course, you can go in space, that's a whole different topic. But if you want to stay on the ground, you can build a next generation of gravitational wave detectors, which will be the third, hence 3G. There are two main designs on the table right now. One is called the Einstein telescope. It will go underground in the current configuration to gain low frequency. And the other one, it's called Cosmic Explorer. It will be on the ground, just a longer version of LIGO. So instead of 4 kilometers, it will be 40 kilometers. And I'll stop here because there is no time and I'm not an instrument person, but we can discuss about some of the noises later if you want. The point is that if you have these instruments, then you can basically see mergers everywhere in the universe. This cartoon shows how far you can see in redshift mergers for various detectors as a function of the source frame total mass. So while, say, advanced LIGO can see neutron stars up to redshift of 0.1 once at design, with a 3G Cosmic Explorer, you can see them basically well past the point where you expect to have stars in the universe. For binary black holes, this is a 15914, you can see them up to redshift of 10, 20, whatever. So this has quite a lot of consequences. This means that these detectors are incredibly sensitive. So this changes a few things. One of them is that while advanced LIGO design, and advanced LIGO for me means LIGO, Virgo, and Kagra, everything, not particularly LIGO. Once a design, we'll see, say, binary black holes in this range, up to redshift, say, a 1-ish, depending on the mass. The third generation will see black holes basically everywhere. This is the distribution of redshift of measurable or detectable binary black holes. And so that's good. You can follow them through cosmic history. The other nice thing is that most of your events, which comes from where there is most space in the universe, which is a redshift of 1-ish, will be quite loud. So while in advanced LIGO and Virgo and so on and so forth, it is the case that if you plot the distribution of SNRs of expected detection, it will go like SNR to the minus 4. So most events will be weak or marginal. The same distribution for third generation will actually have a peak away from threshold. So, you know, your typical event will not be, you know, a small thing in the data. And the other thing, which is important, is that, again, notice that the peak of the detection redshift for advanced LIGO, it's well before the peak of the redshift distribution in the universe. While for 3G, you see all of them. What does that imply? That implies that you are not going to get a distribution of inclination, which is the blue one anymore. Remember, the blue distribution here was the convolution of two things. Isotropy plus most energy goes along plus and minus L, so you can see these events farther away, and there is more universe farther away. That's not true anymore for 3G, because for 3G, you see all the universe anyway, okay? So for 3G, you really recover the isotropic distribution of inclination angle. And that gives you, together with better spin measurements, a few other bonus things like better ring down test, distance estimation, and so on and so forth. Right, in the interest of time, let me skip a couple of slides and go to here. So what does that imply for spin distribution? This is the plot I showed before for advanced LIGO. That's for the first object. Since Mina, you asked, that's for the secondary object. You can see that typically, notice a different scale. It typically is unmeasurable, okay? And now if you get a similar population for 3G, you get this distribution. Different colors are different network, but it doesn't matter. The point is that they all look the same. And for example, the median of this uncertainty, it's around 0.5. So for 50% of my 3G detection, I will measure the component spin with a 90% uncertainty better than 0.5, which is pretty good. And even for the secondary spin, there are events for which we can say something. And of course, even in 3G, it will be the case that you can do even better for the effective spin. Now, and sorry, that's from a different paper, so a different style. And in here, you see the 90% uncertainty in the measurements of chi effective. These are different network configuration. Again, if I focus on 3G, is the last two violin plots. This is for nearby events, where nearby means anything smaller than 3 in redshift, farther away and the farthest. And you can see that the median chi effective uncertainty, if you have 2 3G, it's on the order of better than 0.1, okay, where the best events can go even to 10 to the minus 2. So we'll measure this guy extremely well. And the same, at least for the nearby events. Same is true for the final spin. Again, here we can go very easily to 10 to the minus 2. All right, last thing, promise, I want to explicitly show you, because the problem with these plots, which I like, is that I drawn these events from a distribution which was uniform in comoving volume, okay? And since I mentioned this already a few times, let me tell you what this explicitly means, is that if this is z and this is p of z, your distribution is something like this, okay? Where this is, you know, say 1 to 2, depending on a few things. And the tail is much longer. So this means that if I randomly draw my redshift from this distribution, the probability that I get something very, very small, small meaning the guys we are detecting now, it's very, very small. So when I did this paper, when we wrote this paper, by randomly drawing, nothing in here was closer than z of 0.3, okay? So I wanted to complement this study by explicitly looking at what happens if I get a 15 or 9, 14, say. We know that they exist. We know that they can merge at a 0.1 of redshift. How well can I characterize 15 or 9, 14 with a 3G detector? That's exactly the idea. And the question is relevant because with a 3G detector, a cosmic explorer, 5914 will have an SNR of 2000. So, you know, close to you'll be able to hear with your ear. Right, so, and I wanted to compare how well you can do with how well we have done, as, you know, with the LIGO-Virgo collaboration by measuring some of the parameters of 5914. These are reminders for a few of them. You know, mass ratio and effective spin at 90% uncertainty of 0.3-ish. And for the distance, it was, you know, close to 100%, you know, say 80%, whatever. And the another spin parameter I've not mentioned today because it's very hard to measure today is the precessing spin, which is similar to the chi effetti, but instead of being projected along L, it's projected perpendicular to L, kind of. It's not exactly like this, but it gives you an idea. It controls the amount of precession. So this is what you can do for these parameters, or some of these parameters, with a single 3G detector. So in here you see the chi effective. The true value was minus 0.12, and the various curves are different 3G configuration. And you can see that not only you can exclude that it's positive, but it's basically it's a delta. It's pretty impressive. This is the precessing chi, and again, while with advanced detectors, it's going to be very hard to measure most of the times, I suspect. Here you can measure it pretty well. This is the final spin. I'm sorry for the label, but here is not 640, and this is not 654, whatever. So it's, again, an extremely precise measurement. And the last one is the mass ratio. What I found impressive in this plot is that the true value is 0.97 or ish, and they can exclude one, basically. Okay, so which is incredibly nice. All right, so we only need $1 billion. Please don't forget to leave an offer when you leave. Okay. Since I'm late, so let me just leave this here. There is no point for me repeating all of this stuff, is what I just said. And sorry for running late. Thank you. And more the chair is in charge. So
yes.
I'm here for lunch too, if people have more questions. The chair is chairing.
On those plots for speed determination, like a few slides before, I think you cut it around like 20 solar mass, like
there is a good reason for that is that as I quickly mentioned before, we started working on this paper right after the 15914 discovery, which is this object here, okay, which has this component, this chirp mass frame. Now when that happened, we realized that in the literature there was nothing basically that showed how well you can measure the spins or anything for heavy black holes. And the reason is, I mean, it's Jack's fault, because these guys told us that all black holes are masses below 15, right? So all the literature had, you know, this side already covered. That's why we focus on this,
okay,
on this side.
How does that side look like?
Is
it different?
It is basically, I don't know if there is a plot which looks exactly like this, but with some modulus on conversion, like these results here will give you an idea, okay? I can try to recast this in a way that looks like that. I can do it. But it's better because you have more and more in spiral. Okay. I don't know what's next.
Yeah, I was curious about the precession timescale and how much that changes with like mass ratio and the spins and so on.
You mean how it is compared to the orbital timescale or what?
I guess what I was really wondering is for the third generation, I assume that you get a big boost if you can in your precision overall in measuring spin if you can constrain the precession.
Oh yeah.
I wondered, you know, you need signal early on in the waveform.
So you need, I mean, to do that better, one of the ways that, yeah, you go to, you get better lower frequency because you have more precession cycles early. I don't know if I have, okay, well, that's not very good, but you have a lot of precession cycles at low frequency because the frequency doesn't vary a lot, right? The orbital frequency. And yeah, so we can do that, and that's a painful actually thing that you mentioned, because I have to reveal one of the dirty secrets of that analysis is that if you look at the 3G curves, the Einstein telescope one, say, that can go down to a few hertz in sensitivity, which is perfect for this kind of things, right? Now, the problem with it, though, is that none of the results I show you go down to 1 hertz, say, when I do the analysis. I stop at 10 hertz, okay? Why is this so? Because not only you have more spiral cycles, but you also have a very long waveform to calculate if you go down to 1 hertz, right? The duration of the waveform blows up with the lower frequency to some positive power, okay? So calculating these days in spiral measuring down waveform starting from 1 hertz and doing that 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7 times, which is what you need for doing these Monte Carlo studies, it is computationally prohibitive. Now, you could do something else. You can do Fisher metrics kind of things. As far as I know, it's not as easy when you have precession. I don't know if there are there Fisher metrics with full IMR precessing waveforms? I'm not aware of any. I think they have to assume that the spins are aligned. They use IMR phenom C.
There's numerical calculations, but it's not. There's no results from that published yet.
So. Right. Anyhow, so yeah, I mean, so to go back to your question, yeah, indeed, it will get much better as you go to lower frequency because you get a lot of these precession cycles. I mean, no, I don't want to lie to you. In some other version of my slides, maybe it's still there, I have a whole slides of caveats for 3G. One of them is computational challenges. There are many other. The other one is that, it's in my conclusion slides, you will have on the order of 10 to the 5 binary black hole per year, and a similar or larger number than for neutron stars. So at any given, you know, time, there is a quite large probability that the signals overlap, okay? Now, there are ways of dealing with that. People are already looking into this, and it's a problem for LISA already, for example. So that is pretty amazing how in a single like factor of 10 improvement, we can go from the first detection of humankind to having too many detections to handle and see in the whole, you know, the universe.
That'll be a great problem to have.
Yeah.
So, and even so, to give people a bit of a midpoint in between this and the current state of LIGO, like at the sign sensitivity, the rough expectation rates of detection is like one binary black hole per day and one binary neutron star per week.
And month. That's why you're going to open up the detector right away.
Yeah. Done promise.
Yes, promised.
I mean, you're chatting. I'm just.
You said a little bit about the approximations for the waveform models used to get these results and any
right.
Systematic effects that might.
Yeah, and that's a good. Those are all good questions. So the main. So okay, for those of you who love waveforms, not all of these results. Most of these results have been produced with a waveform called IMR Phenom PV2, which is a phenomenological waveform, which is tuned against numerical relativity waveforms, and it has a spiral merger. Ring down and precession. What are the caveats? It does not have higher order modes. Okay, so a priori, I should not use it for something which has a mass ratio of several or very large masses, total mass, because in this case you enhance the production of higher order modes and the energy that goes there. And but if anything, I would expect, and if someone in the audience can be more precise, they should. I would expect that this can make things better. And maybe actually, Carl, you have done this on the IMBH paper because you have more information that breaks degeneracies, right?
So for the IMBH paper, we didn't have any higher order modes.
All right, Phil added, right? Phil, Alessandra, yeah.
We didn't have any spins. And we decided that spins are more important.
That's the kind of
but
problem.
Like, there are several waveform models that are being in development right now, which have both spins and hybrid
right.
modes, and like half line. And to those, you can then add the precessional effects, as well as any like further matter and tidal effects on top of that. So it's a bit more modular than
like you, that way sort of adding in the extra bit of physics without having to redevelop the entire waveform families.
The other thing is, thanks, Carl. The other thing is that these waveforms, these IMR waveforms, have been shown to have a very good match with an R waveform, say, for small to moderate inclination angles, okay? Which is good for these days because that's everything we're going to get. But if your system is very close to a John, there is a LIGO paper on this, for example, and where people have shown that the faithfulness of this IMR waveform against something else kind of can decline if you're too close to a John. And you know, typically I'm a very honest person, so in this paper, there is a whole section on caveats, okay? So everything that could be wrong with this analysis or needs to be improved in the future is explicitly spelled out, one of these papers, that paper, I think. Anything else on waveform systematics that I cannot think of?
For the SNR, so the current waveform, we're lucky
thank you.
We are accurate to SNRs of like 30.
Thank you.
If you go to SNRs of 100 or 1,000, these waveforms are not good enough.
Thank you. We actually have seen this explicitly in this paper here, and also another paper that Carl and Aaron are involved. So these results, these measurements were first obtained, okay, slightly, it's tangentially related to what they're talking about. Something that you need to know is that on the top of having the IMR waveform, if you want to make your life even faster, you can use something which is called reduced order quadrature, which is a way of, Carl is the master, he will tell you, of making the likelihood calculation faster. That comes with some approximations, which for our everyday advanced LIGO Virgo life are perfect. But when I try to run that approximation with this SNR 2000 thing, what happens is that all of my posterior were equally narrow, but all, or most of them, they were biased away, right? And the truth is that is exactly what Christian is saying, is that, you know, every method can come with some small systematic, but as long as your systematic are much smaller than your statistical error, then it's fine, okay? Let's say it's fine. But as the SNR increases, this width gets smaller and smaller, so any systematic, you're gonna pay it, and you're gonna see it very clearly. So part of the development that needs to happen, you know, in the next 20 years as we build this thing, it's to be sure that we have waveforms which are not good to the percent level like today, but the sub-percent level, because... Say again?
Yeah, that's going to happen. Even doing nothing is going to happen.
Okay. Even doing nothing, okay.
Yeah, more slow will get you there.
We should stop on this optimistic, it's never going to get better.
Let's go to lunch and thanks all again.
Yeah, thank you.